And we try to get the most updated information about Imam of our time from our experts. And today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Dr. Karibi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Dr. Karimi, we have been talking about the consequences of the heavenly call and the satanic call. We talked about the content. We talked about the content of heavenly call. We talked about the content of the satanic call. And then you talked about the consequences. Are there any more consequences remaining from the calls?
As I mentioned in the previous session, some people are going to be affected by the satanic call. As we have in every time and era, people who know the truth, but they are going to follow the falsehood. They are going to follow the Iblis, the Satan.
Right.
It seems that it is not the case that people will confuse the heavenly call and the satanic call. Because as we explained today, there are ways to distinguish between the two. And the ways are very crystal clear. But the point is that in each time we have people following the falsehood, although they already know the truth.
Right.
So we said that after the heavenly call, according to the narrations, because of different aspects, one of them being the miraculous aspect of that heavenly call, all people will believe in Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. But then Satan will try to mislead the people, and he is successful in misleading a group of people, the people of battle or falsehood. So this satanic call will cause some doubts in the hearts of some people. Some of them, they reject that heavenly call. They reject following Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. And according to some narrations, not only that, some of them, they call the heavenly call a magic by the Ahlul Bayt and by the followers of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam.
Right.
Because it is, a miracle based on what we mentioned about the features. And we have it in the history of the prophets and the imams that the enemies, when they saw miracles, they used to call them magic. For example, in one narration we read, فَيَرْجُعَ مَنْ أَرَضَ اللَّهُ عَزَّ وَجَلْ بِهِمْ سُوءًا. This raja'a, this return, means that after the heavenly call, all people will believe in Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. But for some people, after hearing the satanic call, they will return.
Now they will be double-hearted,
Exactly. They are going to follow the Satan and reject Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. وَيَقُولُونَ هَذَا سِحْرُ الشِّيعَ. They say that this heavenly call is the magic of the Shia.
Okay.
And the Imam says that وَهُوَ قَوْلُ اللَّهِ عَزَّ وَجَلَّ. Imam says that what they are saying is referring to what is mentioned in the Noble Book of Quran in chapter Qamar, chapter 54, verse 2. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. وَإِنْ يَرَوْا آيَةً يُعْرِضُوا. When they see a sign, they turn away. وَيَقُولُوا سِحْرٌ مُسْتَمَرٌ. And they say an incessant magic. So again, the history is repeating itself. Exactly. And the other narration reads, when they hear the satanic call, this group of people, they would disassociate from us, the Ahlul Bayt, and then they say, إِنَّ الْمُنَادِ الْأَوَّلْ سِحْرٌ مِنْ سِحْرِ أَهْلِ الْبَيْتِ. The first caller, that is the heavenly call, is a magic from the magic of the Ahlul Bayt, نَعُوذُ بِاللَّهِ. Then Imam Sadiq alayhi salam also recited the verse 2 of chapter Qamar, chapter 54. And of course, for the believers, it would cause more certainty because
already they have heard
this heavenly call. Now they are listening and they are hearing the satanic call. So for them, it would cause more certainty about
the
truth.
And especially when there's this contemplation in the verses of Quran, there's less chance of getting misled. Now, we would talk more with you, Dr. Karimi. Let's take a short break. We'll be back in a while.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. This thousand-year-old pain.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is The Last Savior. We are with Dr. Karimi, and we're talking about the heavenly call and the satanic call, and what are the differences between the two. We talked about the content, we talked about the consequences, and now Dr. Karimi would want you to tell us about the ways. How can we detect which one is the heavenly call and which one is the satanic call?
One of the main responsibilities and duties of us, the Shia living in this time of the major occultation, is to increase our knowledge regarding Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, and especially these definite signs for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. So the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, they have explained everything about how to distinguish between the two calls. But the point is that we might have some Shia who are not aware of these narrations, so maybe this is one of the reasons that we are talking about these series of discussions in our programs.
Right.
My point is that this is already mentioned by the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. So if someone is going to be confused, he should blame himself,
right,
and no one else, because already everything is clear. Having said that, there are a couple of points through which people can very easily distinguish between the two calls. The first point is that the heavenly call precedes the satanic call. So this is very clear that...
So the first call is
exactly,
going to be the heavenly
call. The first call is the heavenly call, and then we will have the satanic call. So
okay.
If some people are confused, they just can distinguish by seeing which one is
first
and which one is coming second. Even if we have two heavenly calls, then we go to the content, as I will explain later. This is very clear based on the narrations that the satanic call will not come first. First of all, we have the
heavenly call,
and as a reaction to it, we will have the satanic call. We have in the narrations that the first call, the first voice is coming from Jibreel. So the second voice, the second call, is coming from the earth, وَهُوَ صَوْتُ Iblis, and that would be the voice of Iblis. Al-Ghiba by Nu'mani, page 262, hadith number 13. Also, of all the people on the earth, without any exception, they would believe after hearing the first call.
Right.
That is the heavenly call. So this is a very easy way to distinguish and not to be confused.
Right.
After hearing these two calls. The other point is that if we already are aware of all these points, and especially the content of these two calls, the heavenly call and the satanic call,
then
we
there's
are able,
no point of confusion.
Exactly. There won't be any confusion. This is mentioned in the narrations as well. And interestingly, this was a concern for the companions of the Imam of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam as well, that when we have two calls, how we are able to distinguish
between the two.
So this was asked already by the companions of the Imam of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. For example, Zurara says that who are the people, or how we are able to distinguish the Sadiq, the true call, from Kadhib, from
the false ones.
And the Imam says, يَعْرِفُهُ الَّذِينَ كَانُوا يَرْوُونَ حَدِيثَنَا. Those people who narrate our narrations, they know how to distinguish. Because
right.
As I mentioned, the ways are mentioned in the narrations. Al-Ghiba by Nu'mani, page 272, hadith number 28.
Right. So definitely we would want to know more from you, Dr. Karimi, but let's take a short break and we'll be back in a while. Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is The Last Savior. We are with Dr. Karimi and we're talking about the ways in which we can distinguish between the heavenly call and the satanic call. Yes, Dr. Karimi.
Again, I would like to repeat this point that it was a question, a concern of the companions of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, that how we are able to distinguish between the two. I'm not sure how many of the Shia of our time, they have the same question, the concern. They know enough knowledge about these two
calls
and the ways to distinguish between the two. But the narrations tell us that this was a concern.
And of the companions as
who,
well.
Yeah, lived centuries ago. So, for example, Abdul Rahman bin Maslama says that one of the companions of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he says that I told Imam Sadiq alayhi salam that some people reprimand us and they say that you claim that there would be two calls, a heavenly call and a satanic call. How you're able to distinguish between the truth and the falsehood? Imam Sadiq alayhi salam told him that what is your answer to these people? Abdul Rahman said we have no response.
Right.
Imam is referring to some general points that those people who are the people of the belief, they will accept the heavenly call. And then the Imam refers to some other points regarding this distinguishing between the two calls, referring to the fact that this was a concern.
Right.
Again, Hishab ibn Salim says that I told Imam Sadiq alayhi salam that a man called Jariri, he is telling us that you Shia claim that there are two calls. There would be two calls. Which one is the truth and which one is
a fake one?
A fake one. And Imam says that tell him, and the Imam explains. Also, another companion of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam asked the Imam that Hisham ibn Salim that how we can distinguish between two, and the Imam explains.
Okay.
So this is showing the importance of this topic, and as Shia in this time and era, we also need to be aware of the ways through which we can distinguish between,
the two. The more information we have about the Imam of our time, the more it's good for us, the more we are close to him, the more we are ready to be his companions, to be his soldiers.
Mm-hmm. So just regarding knowing through the content, we talked in details about the content of the heavenly call and the satanic call. And the Imam of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam also, they have told the Shia that one of the ways through which you can distinguish between the two calls is the fact that, for example, Alamatul Dhalik, the sign for it, for the heavenly call, for the true call, is that Annahu Yunada Bismil Qa'im Wasma'abi. In that heavenly call, he will call out, Jibreel will call and will mention the name of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam and the name of his father. So these are not going to be mentioned in the satanic call.
Right.
So the content is very, very
important
and through that we can distinguish between the two calls. And the last point, again mentioned in the narrations, is that, as I mentioned, as Shia, if we already are familiar with the narrations, we are able easily to distinguish between the two calls.
Right.
As we mentioned, the first call and the second call, and
right,
the content is different.
Right.
But the Imam of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam also have talked about the people who may not be aware of all these narrations, and they are asking the Shia to refer to the experts, the scholars.
Okay.
So after the reappearance of the Imam of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, maybe we have some Shia who may be confused.
Right.
And the Imam says that, answering Zurara bin A'yun, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says that, يَعْرِفَهُ الَّذِينَ كَانُوا يَرْوُونَ حَدِيثَنَا. Those people who narrate our narrations, they know this heavenly call. Meaning that if you are not aware, if you are not familiar with the ways through which you can distinguish between the two, then refer to the scholars.
Right.
Then refer to the experts in this regard.
Right.
So the last point in this regard is that for those people who are not knowledgeable enough, they need to refer to the religious scholars of that time.
Right. Thank you so much, Doctor, for being with us and giving us that detailed information, and that too with the exact narrations, the addresses that you provide. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of life? Where is the shining moon? Where is the firmest glow? Please, oh please, please come. Thank you.
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Iran's leader, addressing thousands of people from the provinces of Sistan and Balochistan and South Khorasan. He also said the U.S. and Europe do not have the same powers as before and are declining. The leader may be referring to the rise of powerful blocs like BRICS or the SCO. BRICS in particular has just recently expanded from its current 5 members to include new members like Iran and Saudi Arabia. And here's a map of the world outlining BRICS countries. It is pretty obvious how the U.S. and Europe are the minority. U.S. intervention in other countries' affairs, whether through wars, regime change, or economic sanctions, has led to the polarization of the world. The leader called the U.S. failure in Syria and the humiliating escape from Afghanistan two obvious examples of the decline of American power. It's a toss-up between which of these two failures were more humiliating. Right now, the U.S. is occupying Syria, looting the country from its oil, and selling it to provide for his troops there, and by many accounts, to support the terrorists in northern Syria. That is a low for any country. A big slap in the face to France and colonialism. From Mali to Niger to Gabon, African countries are rising against the colonial country France, which has held these countries captive economically. But the people of these countries have now risen, saying that enough is enough. Iran's leader has said you hear these days how the African countries that were under the influence of France are rising against it one after another. Elsewhere in his remarks, the leader stated that Washington is working on ethnic and sectarian fault lines in Iran with the aim of creating a crisis in the country. Some of the areas that he outlined, called crisis points, are ethnic differences, religious differences, and the issue of gender and women. But this is something that the U.S. has executed for quite some time. Back in the year 2007, it was revealed that the CIA was funding ethnic separatist groups to create instability in Iran. These incidents were carried out by the Kurds in the west, the Azeris in the northwest, the Ahwazi Arabs in the southwest, and the Baluchis in the southeast. The incidents included bombing and assassination campaigns against Iranian soldiers and government officials. There was also the Iran Freedom Support, an act of Congress approved by the former U.S. President George W. Bush, that appropriated millions of dollars to spend money in support of groups opposed to the Iranian government. Iran's leader statements have come at a time when there is an intense campaign to turn the unfortunate passing away of Mahsa Amini's one-year anniversary into a violent one.
The commission is the premier UN body for promoting gender equality and empowering women. It cannot do its important work if it's being undermined from within. Iran's membership at this moment is an ugly stain on the commission's credibility.
One member, a bullying member, notorious for disobeying the UN Charter and international law, intends to pursue its unlawful request to remove an elected member from the commission only on the basis of unfounded claims and fabricated arguments.
The crisis in Niger is deepening further as junta leaders accuse France of deploying forces in the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, as part of preparations for a potential military intervention following the coup on July 26.
It should be pointed out to national and international public opinion that since the announcement of this withdrawal plan, France has continued to deploy its forces in several ECOWAS countries as part of the preparations for an aggression against Niger that is planning in collaboration with this community organization.
The junta says France has deployed military aircraft and armored vehicles in multiple countries for such aggressive actions.
100 or so rotations of military cargo planes unloaded large quantities of war material and equipment in Senegal, Ivory Coast and Benin, to name but a few. The CNSP and the transitional government denounce and castigate this lack of sincerity. These underhand delaying tactics are designed to dull the patriotic order of the Niger people in their fight for the total withdrawal of French troops from Niger in order to achieve a more successful military intervention against our country.
The statement prompted an immediate response from Paris. French President Emmanuel Macron stated that he would only take action upon the request of the deposed Nigerian leader Mohamed Bazoum.
If we redeploy anything, it'll only be at the demand of Bazoum and in coordination with him, not with those people who are holding a president hostage.
President Macron emphasized that France fully supports the position of ECOWAS, which has stated that military intervention is being considered as an option to reinstate Bazoum as president. Relations between Niger and its former colonizer, France, have deteriorated since Paris deemed the junta illegitimate. In the meantime, anti-French sentiment has been growing in Niger, with thousands of people regularly gathering in the capital, Niamey, to demand the withdrawal of French forces and its ambassador from the country. The developments in Niger come as people across the West African nation have been demanding withdrawal of French troops since the military junta took power following the July coup. This is part of a call from the junta for Nigerians to persist until the complete expulsion of French forces.
This is why the National Council for the Protection of the Fatherland and the transitional government launch a solemn appeal to the great people of Niger to be vigilant and never to demobilize until the inevitable departure of French troops from our territory.
However, it is worth noting that Niger is not the sole country where anti-French sentiment has been prevalent. A glance at recent political changes and military coups in Africa, particularly across the Sahel region, suggests that public demands for the departure of French forces have played a significant role in triggering these military takeovers. Testimonies to this trend can be observed in Mali, Guinea, Burkina Faso, and the most recent case in Niger. In Niger's context, the country has been grappling with growing insecurity exacerbated by political instability and armed insurgencies. Moreover, despite being a resource-rich nation with a population of 26 million, Niger is considered one of the poorest countries on Earth, according to UN figures. Given the extensive involvement of France in Niger, both politically and economically, the general public there attributes many of their grievances to Paris. One may wonder why Niger has long been easy prey for Paris. Niger boasts strategic mineral reserves, including uranium, gold, and crude oil, among others. Notably, France holds mineral rights for uranium mining, which fuels its nuclear power plants. Consequently, Paris heavily relies on Niger's uranium mines. This has led Nigerians to perceive their country as a victim of French exploitation, with their resources being undervalued. Recognizing that other Sahelian countries may face a similar fate, African people are awakening to the reality that Western powers, particularly France, have maintained their presence primarily to exploit their resources. This realization has prompted Nigerians and other West African nations to assert that the era of colonialism is over, and they themselves must put an end to decades of Western occupation and economic exploitation in their countries. A recent visit by U.S. delegation led by Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Ethan A. Gorish to northeastern Syria has drawn outrage from Damascus. In a statement, the Syrian Foreign Ministry branded the entry of the delegation to the country's territory as unauthorized. The ministry categorically condemned the visit as what it called flagrant violations of Syria's sovereignty and a breach of international law and the United Nations Security Council resolutions. That after the delegation, led by Gorish and a military officer, met with commanders of U.S.-backed militant groups, including Syrian Democratic Forces, or SDF, and tribal leaders earlier in September in the eastern province of Deir ez-Zor. The ministry said the delegation's meeting further exacerbated concerns regarding Syria's sovereignty and international legal principles. The ministry dismissed the delegation's claim that their visit was aimed at addressing issues faced by residents in Deir ez-Zor, calling it a blatant lie. It said the event underscores the hypocritical stance taken by U.S. administration. The Syrian Foreign Ministry stressed that U.S. is actively exploiting Syria's resources and capabilities while at the same time imposing unilateral economic sanctions, describing the measures as unjust, illegitimate, inhumane, and immoral. The ministry asserted that the U.S.'s blatant interference in Syria's domestic affairs, along with its extensive support for various terrorist groups and separatist militias, only serves to underline the destructive role played by Washington in the Arab country. The reaction by the Syrian government comes as U.S.-backed militant groups hold control to the east of the Euphrates River, while the Syrian government forces are positioned on the western bank. The United States also maintains military installations in the area, including the country's largest gas field, Alomar. The visit led by Gorish and a U.S. Army officer to Syria follows another trip by an American delegation to the country's northwest last month. The high-level delegation included three members of the U.S. Congress, Ben Klein, Scott Fitzgerald, and French Hill, all members of the U.S. Republican Party, who visited parts of Aleppo province with a claim of highlighting the ongoing humanitarian catastrophe there. But the interesting point about U.S. delegations' recent trips is that all those visits were made to areas controlled by foreign-backed terrorists and not ordinary areas. The recent visits also come in the light of Washington's all-out support for foreign-backed militants there. For over a decade, the United States has left no stone unturned to provide financial and logistical support to the terrorists, including Daesh, with the aim of overthrowing the democratically elected president of Syria. Reports on the ground indicate that the United States has recently increased its support for the terrorist groups in parts of Syria controlled by foreign-backed militants. Testimony to that is the deadly terror attacks carried out by Daesh over the past months. The most recent incident occurred on August 10th when Daesh terrorists ambushed a bus in Deir ez-Zor province, resulting in the tragic loss of 32 Syrian soldiers. Concurrently, despite the existence of U.S. coalition-controlled camps in Syria, particularly the Al-Hawl camp in Hasakah province, which functions as a primary detention and holding facility for Daesh terrorists, the activities of the terror group have surged. Some Lebanese media have cited Russian officials that the U.S. support for Daesh terrorists in certain areas in Syria has significantly increased. Maybe that is why the Secretary General of the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah, has talked of U.S. plans to revive Daesh in an effort to justify its role in the West Asia region. All what it is that U.S. intentions to provide as much support to the terrorists as it can are not secret to anyone. But the real intention is, as the Syrian government has numerously complained about, to plunder the country's resources, including its oil and gas reserves.
A recent video circulating on social media shows Israeli soldiers of the Army's Golani Brigade rioting during a training session in protest against the far-right Israeli cabinet of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's recent controversial policies. The leaked video shows dozens of soldiers from Israel's Golani Brigade shouting and vandalizing property. According to the reports, several of the protest participants had been disciplined by superiors, resulting in the arrest of several soldiers, including sergeants. The regime's Golani Brigade is mostly made up of elite soldiers specialized in ground warfare. They have carried out armed attacks against Palestinians and have participated in almost all the wars waged by the regime. Ever since the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced the proposal for the judicial overhaul, which limits the authority of the national judiciary, the public has held mass demonstrations across Israel. Tens of thousands of military personnel from different sectors of the Israeli army have protested against the decision, including 10,000 reservists from intelligence units and Air Force pilots. They have threatened to no longer show up for duty in protest of Netanyahu's judicial reform efforts. Last month, Israel's Air Force chief suspended a number of senior military reserve forces in the wake of ongoing demonstrations against Netanyahu's judicial overhaul plan. The development came a day after the Israeli Navy suspended two high-ranking reservists after they announced plans to end volunteer reserve duties, in addition to refusing to serve in what they called a dictatorship. Also, cases of suicide within the Israeli occupation forces have grabbed headlines recently, with observers blaming a mental health epidemic among soldiers. In July, Israel's chief of staff, General Herzi Halevi, warned that the army's unity has dangerously deteriorated due to the thousands of reservists who have threatened to hold service in protest against the judicial overhaul Israel faces. He also warned that Israel would be in existential peril. Some other Israeli military officials have warned that the reservists' protests are impacting military readiness amid heightened tension between Israel and the axis of resistance, including Hezbollah, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and Hamas in recent months. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his supporters have rejected the reservists' protests as a dangerous and unprecedented form of political blackmail by the military, with some equating the protests to attempts at a military coup. Despite the threat of reservists refusing service, Netanyahu's far-right cabinet pushed ahead with the judicial overhaul legislation. The Knesset passed the legislation in a vote in July, despite months of large protests. The legislation struck down the ability of Israel's Supreme Court to veto legislation passed by the Knesset based on the criteria of reasonableness.
Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, has said, "Whenever I remembered the martyrdom of the children of Fatima, peace be upon her, my eyes filled with tears."
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, good manner. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the worldly effects of good manner in the Islamic teachings or Islamic lifestyle. When we talk about the good manner, therefore, we need to definitely talk about its effects, that when we follow good effect in our lifestyle, when in the Islamic lifestyle we talk about good effect, what effects it's going to have, this good manner, what effects it should have. So therefore, we can categorize them into different ways or different effects. The first one is the worldly effects. And in that, we can count many, many effects. For example, the first effect that it has, according to the narrations of the Prophet as well, or the Islamic teachings, it says that this good manner or husne khulq, it brings a good friendship amongst the people. It brings the good friendship and a stable friendship. Why? Because the Prophet has said that husnul khulqi yuthabbitul mawadda. It stables the love amongst the friends. That's the first benefit. The second thing that we can see is that it expands the societies, and it expands the life of a person. When we talk about husne khulq, it expands the life of the people. Why? Because people are happy. They are dealing with others with a peace, with a good manner, and it makes others happy. Therefore, it expands the life of the people. And after that, what we can see is that it increases the sustenance, the husne khulq, or the good manner. It also increases the sustenance that we generally earn in this life. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the worldly effects of good manner, and we said that it has different effects, and we were counting some of them. Now, the effects that it has, obviously, it was stabilizing the friendship, it was increasing the life of the people, it was increasing the sustenance of the people. And Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam has said that fi si'ati al-akhlaqi kunuzul arzaq, in the good manner there are many treasures that are hidden. Therefore, after that, the effect that we can count, one of the benefits of the good manner, is that the relation, the social relation of the people, it becomes good, it becomes wider, and it is on the basis of good manner. If the society, if the relationship in the society or social relationship amongst the people is based on the good manner, it is based on the husne khulq, then we can see a good society, a pure society, a kind society. And on top of that, last but not least, the thing that we can see, the effect, the worldly effect which we can count in the good manner, is that it takes us out of the difficulties. You know, the difficulties that we have in our life, everyone has many difficulties in their life. As a society, we have a difficulty. As individuals, we have difficulties. But if we are dealing with the people with a good manner, obviously it solves these problems. We are helping each other. We are being kind to each other. If we see each other as a mu'min brother, as a believer, and we respect each other because of the iman, because of the faith that we have, obviously, this also shows us that we can have a pure and a peaceful life in this world, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
A major United Nations report has said governments around the world are failing to cut carbon emissions fast enough to meet the goals of the Paris Climate Accord and avoid an environmental disaster. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Governments around the world are failing to cut greenhouse gas emissions fast enough to meet the goals of the Paris Climate Accord and to stave off climate disaster, a major report by the United Nations has claimed. Meeting the goals will require phasing out all unabated fossil fuels, the report says, in an acknowledgement that some oil-producing countries may find hard to take. The need to phase out all fossil fuels has not been explicitly adopted by the United Nations before, under successive rounds of climate talks, and language over phasing out or phasing down fossil fuels has caused controversy at the annual United Nations climate talks. There is a rapidly narrowing window for governments to move faster, according to the report, as global greenhouse gas emissions must peak by 2025 at the latest, and be rapidly reduced from there on to limit temperature rises to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. Carbon emissions are still rising, however, and there is a gap of 20 to 23 gigatons of carbon dioxide between the cuts needed by 2030 to limit global temperatures to 1.5 degrees Celsius rise and the world's current emissions trajectory. The report, which was expected next week but was published hurriedly in a draft by the United Nations on Friday, 8th of September, will form the basis of the first global stocktake under the 2015 Paris Climate Accord. That process is meant to track countries' efforts to meet the goals of the treaty. However, the 47-page United Nations report does not set out in detail which countries are falling behind, nor does it contain specific recommendations directed at particular countries or particular regions. Instead, the global situation is described in broad and general terms that were largely predictable, as it has been clear for some time that the world is far off track to stay within the tougher Paris climate goals of limiting temperature rises to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. Anidas Gupta, the head of the World Resources Institute think tank, noted that the bland tone of the report disguised the catastrophic failure. He said, "The United Nations' polite purpose glosses over what is truly damning report card for global climate efforts. The carbon emissions are still climbing, and the rich countries have failed to make finance available to third world countries, lagging woefully behind. This report is a wake-up call to the injustice of the climate crisis and a pivotal opportunity to correct course." The global stocktake will form the basis of negotiations at the next United Nations climate summit, the COP28 summit, to be held in Dubai, United Arab Emirates, next November. We'll be right back. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story and tells us more. Governments around the world are failing to cut greenhouse gas emissions fast enough to meet the goals of the Paris Climate Accord and to stave off climate disaster and environmental disaster, according to a major United Nations report. Meeting the goals of this report will require phasing out of all fossil fuels, the report says, in an acknowledgement to some oil-producing countries, which may take the report hard to accept. While most of the recommendations in the report are unremarkable, exhortations to change transport, buildings and high-carbon industries to reduce the carbon emissions associated with each, the finding on fossil fuels stands out. Buried in a short paragraph midway through the summary of the report, the recommendation on phasing out fossil fuels is clear in its meaning and likely to be explosive in its impact on the negotiations. Achieving net zero carbon dioxide and greenhouse gas emissions requires systems transformations across all sectors and all contexts, including scaling up renewable energy while phasing out all unabated fossil fuels, ending deforestation across the world, reducing non-CO2 emissions, and implementing both supply and demand side measures. The question of phasing out fossil fuels is now at the heart of the United Nations global climate talks. For years, oil-producing nations have prevented the United Nations from adopting language that would clearly require a phasing out of all fossil fuels, even though it is undisputed that burning fossil fuels is the primary cause of the climate crisis. Last year, an attempt to get language on phasing out fossil fuels included in the outcome of the COP27 summit in Egypt failed. Fresh attempts have been made this year, but the United Arab Emirates has so far avoided including language on phasing out fossil fuel emissions in any communications on the COP28 summit. Asked by the Daily Mail, the COP28 President Denigrate, Sultan Al Jaber, would refer only to phasing down fossil fuels. As the global stocktake is the key document for COP28 and forms the basis of negotiations, for this recommendation to be included is highly significant. A spokesperson for the European Commission said the EU was strongly in favour of the measure. "We welcome and agree with such language. Already on several occasions, the Commission and the European Union ministers have called for a move towards energy systems free from all fossil fuels. We see the push for global targets on renewable energy and energy efficiency measures as part of the path to achieve that." Gareth Redmond-King, head of international program at the Energy and Climate Intelligence Unit think tank, said the most important part of the report is key finding 6, commitment that delivering on the Paris Climate Accord means scaling up renewable energy, phasing out all fossil fuels, ending deforestation throughout the world, tackling methane emissions, transformational changes needed to get to net zero and get on track for 1.5 degrees Celsius rise. Because that's setting the agenda for COP28, the discussions to come later this month, and then in Dubai at COP28 itself, the response to this stocktake. That's what needs to be a game changer to shift up a few gears. The report found plenty of measures governments could take to reduce carbon emissions that would be low cost and easy to implement, including investments in renewable energy and conserving and regrowing forests. Some developing countries would require financial help to seize these opportunities, however. There are now sufficient cost-effective opportunities to address the 2030 emissions gap, yet significant challenges, including access to and availability of support, remain in harnessing these opportunities at the required pace and scale.
Thank you. We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
In this episode, we invite you to listen to the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with the Supreme Assembly of Commanders and Officials of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, IRGC, on August 17, 2023, in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniya. The thing that drives the enemy to stand against Islam is the political rule of Islam. The political rule of Islam is what was achieved due to the efforts of the Iranian nation and with the leadership of the extraordinary man, our magnanimous Imam Khomeini, who was truly one of a kind, and is what drove the enemies to line up in front of it. The next question is, what feature does the political rule of Islam have that makes them sensitive? What is it that causes them to react? This is important. We must think deeply about this. The deeper, more accurate and clear our understanding of the Islamic Revolution is, the greater our commitment to protecting it will be. Of course, if we wanted to discuss this issue, it would take more than 1 or 2 hours. Long discussions are required to talk about the features of the Islamic system, Islamic society, and Islamic politics. I will just briefly touch on a few points here.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The Islamic political system opposes oppression. It opposes the oppressor. It's that simple. Be opposed to the oppressor. This is what we are told. The commander of the faithful, Imam Ali alayhi salam, who is the epitome of the true Islam, said in his will to those who were the dearest elements in the world, his two children, to oppose the oppressor and to support the oppressed. That's the first thing. If a political system, an organization, or a power in the world is based on oppression, then it will obviously oppose this system, because it knows that this system will be opposed to it. The Zionist regime is based on oppression. They drove a nation out of their homes and took everything they had, not with money and request, but with using guns, clubs, and torture. Then they occupied their places. That regime is based on oppression. Well, definitely, the Zionist regime will oppose a system of governance that is opposed to the oppressor. The Islamic system is opposed to taking possessions of the interests of other nations, even if they do not have the same belief and behavior. And do not let hatred of the people inside you to not act equitably. This is mentioned in the Holy Quran, Surah 5, Ayah 8.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. guiding me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You've guided me.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
They have waited years for justice that will never come. Mark Kelly's sister, Carol Ann, was murdered during the Troubles in Northern Ireland.
12 years of age. She was shot in the back of the head. She was shot behind her left ear. And there is absolutely no reason in the world that anyone can give any parent or brother or sister as to why their little sister should be murdered on their own street at the front door of her house.
Mark and hundreds more in Northern Ireland may never have closure now, under the UK government's so-called legacy bill that grants immunity to IRA volunteers and to British soldiers for historical atrocities there. It's proving a huge test for Anglo-Irish relations too. Amid a chorus of criticism from around the world, the Republic of Ireland is weighing up a human rights case against London for the first time in more than five decades.
Everyone, no matter who was affected, whether you were affected by IRA violence, paramilitary violence by the state itself. Everyone has a right to justice, some kind of justice. And the very least, to investigate whatever had happened to their loved ones. I mean, and that's just the basics, Article 2 of the European Convention, you know.
Under the new legislation, if anyone accused of murder gives information to a so-called truth recovery body, they'll escape prosecution. An attempt, many say, by the British government to hide the truth.
There were hundreds of IRA volunteers that went to jail during the conflict. But if we look at, in stark contrast to British soldiers or the paramilitary RUC, not one ever served a full sentence for the killing of civilians during the conflict. In fact, a number of British soldiers were let out early and given medals once they went back into the British Army. So there's a stark contrast between both. This is really about immunity for British soldiers.
The legislation is now going through the House of Lords, where it's not expected to receive any amendments. And after that, it's going to receive royal assent in just a couple of days. But the victims' families say it's not going to deter them in their pursuit for justice.
3,500 people were killed during the conflict between Protestants loyal to British rule and the majority Catholics who wanted to break away from it. 2,500 of those cases remain unresolved. And it's those who have already paid the most who are being asked to pay again. Saeed Pereza, London.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has told European Parliament Foreign and Defence Committee members that Ukraine will join the military alliance.
Ukraine has never been closer to a membership in NATO than now.
Having allegedly provoked Moscow for years, Stoltenberg was accused at the hearing of now turning his sights on Beijing under Washington's direction.
China has not illegally invaded and bombed a sovereign country in over 40 years, while the US and our allies have hardly stopped in the same period, killing millions of civilians, displacing millions more.
NATO's 31 member states have been called on to stop dithering.